Chapter 31. The farewell party for Roland began punctually at 6 o'clock. It lasted only an hour. Business started again at 7. The table was set in an adjoining room. All the whores were dressed. Most of them wore black silk dresses. Having always seen them naked or in a few thin wisps, Ravitch had difficulty in recognizing a number of them. Only half a dozen had been left behind in the big room as an emergency force. They would change at 7 o'clock and be served then. None of them would come in their professional costumes. This was not Madame's rule. The girls themselves wanted it this way. Ravitch had not expected anything else. He knew the etiquette among whores. It was stricter than that of high society. The girls had collected money and given Roland 6 wicker chairs as a present for her restaurant. Madame had presented her with a cash register. Ravitch with 2 marble tables to go with the wicker chairs. He was the only outsider at this party, and the only man. The dinner started at 6:05. Madame presided. Roland sat at her right, Ravitch at her left. Then followed the new gouvernante, the assistant gouvernante, and the rows of girls. The hors d'oeuvres were excellent. Strasbourg goose liver, pâté maison, and old sherry to go with it. Ravitch was served a bottle of vodka. He loathed sherry. This was followed by a vichyssoise of the finest quality, then by turbot with Meursault 1933. The turbot was of the same quality as that served at Maxime's. The wine was light and exactly young enough. Then green asparagus came after it, then roast chicken, crisp and tender, carefully chosen salad with a whiff of garlic, with it a Chateau Saint-Emilion. At the head of the table they were drinking a bottle of Romanée Conti 1921. "The girls don't appreciate it," Madame declared. Ravitch appreciated it. He was served a second bottle. In exchange he passed over the champagne and the mousse chocolat. Together with Madame he ate a ripe brie with the wine and fresh white bread without butter. The conversation at the table was that of a boarding school for young ladies. The wicker chairs were adorned with bows, the cash register glittered, the marble tables gleamed. An air of melancholy pervaded the room. Madame was in black. She wore diamonds, not too many, a brooch and a ring, fine blue-white stones. No coronet, although she had become a countess. She had taste. Madame loved diamonds. She declared that rubies and emeralds were risky, diamonds were safe. She chattered with Roland and Ravitch. She was well-read. Her conversation was amusing, light and witty. She quoted Montaigne, Chateaubriand, and Voltaire. Her white, slightly bluish hair shimmered above her clever, ironical face. At 7 o'clock, after the coffee, the girls rose like obedient young ladies at a boarding school. They thanked Madame politely and took leave of Roland. Madame stayed on for a while. She had an Armagnac brought such as Ravitch had never drunk before. The emergency brigade that had remained on duty came in, washed, less painted than when they were working, dressed in evening gowns. Madame waited until the girls were seated and eating turbot. She exchanged a few words with each of them and expressed her thanks that they had sacrificed the preceding hour. Then she said good-bye graciously. "I'll see you, Roland, before you leave."
"Certainly, Madame."
"May I leave the Armagnac here?" she asked Ravitch. Ravitch thanked her. Madame left, every inch a lady of the highest rank. Ravitch took the bottle and sat down at Roland's side. "When are you going?" he asked.
"Tomorrow afternoon at 4:07.
"I'll be at the station."
"No, Ravitch, that cannot be. My fiancée will be here tonight. We'll leave together. You understand why you can't come?"
"Of course."
"We plan to pick out a few more things tomorrow morning and have everything sent off before we leave. Tonight I'll move into the Hotel Belfort. Good, reasonable, clean."
"Is he staying there too?"
"Of course not," Roland said in surprise. "We are not married yet."
"I see." Ravitch knew that all this was not a pose. Roland was a bourgeois who had been in a profession. Whether it was a boarding school for young ladies or a brothel did not matter. She had completed her professional work. It was over, and she was returning to her bourgeois world without taking a shadow of the other world with her. It was the same with many whores. Some of them became excellent wives. To be a whore was a serious profession, not a vice. That saved them from degradation.
Roland smiled at Ravage, took the bottle of Armagnac, and refilled his glass. Then she took a slip of paper out of her bag. "In case you'd like to get away from Paris some day, here is the address of our house. You can come any time."
Ravage looked at the address.
"There are two names on it," she said. "One is for the first 2 weeks. It's mine. Afterwards, that of my fiancé."
Ravage put the slip into his pocket.
"Thank you, Roland. For the time being, I'll stay in Paris. Besides, your fiancé would certainly be startled if I suddenly dropped in."
"You mean because I don't want you to come to the station?
That's something else. This is only in the event that you have to get away from Paris some day. Quickly. In that event."
He glanced up.
"Why?" "Ravage," she said, "you are a refugee, and refugees are sometimes in difficulties. In that case, it's good to know where one can live without having the police concerned about it."
"How do you know I am a refugee?"
"I know. I haven't told anyone. It's no one's business here. Keep the address. And in case you should need it some day, come. No one will question you at our place."
"All right. Thank you, Roland."
2 days ago, someone from the police was here. He inquired about a German. He wanted to know whether he had been here."
"Really?"
Ravage said attentively.
"Yes. He had been here last time you were in. Probably you don't remember it any more. A stout, bald-headed man. He was sitting there with Yvonne and Claire. The police asked whether he had been here and who else had been here."
"I have no recollection," Ravage said. "I'm sure you didn't pay any attention to him. Of course I didn't say that you were here for a moment that night."
Ravage nodded. "It's better so," Roland declared. "This way one doesn't give the flic a chance to ask innocent people for their passports."
"Naturally. Did he say what he wanted?"
Roland shrugged her shoulders.
"No, and it's none of our business. I told him that no one had been here. That's an old rule of our house. We never know anything. It's better. Nor was he very much interested in it."
"Wasn't he?"
Roland smiled. "Ravage, there are many Frenchmen who don't mind what happens to a German tourist. We have plenty to do for ourselves."
She got up.
"I must go. Adieu, Ravage."
"Adieu, Roland. It won't be the same here without you."
She smiled. "Not right away, perhaps, but soon." She went to say goodbye to the girls. On her way she looked at the cash register, the chairs and tables again. They were practical presents. She saw them in her café already, particularly the cash register. It meant income, security, home, and prosperity. Roland hesitated for a moment, then she could no longer resist. She took a few coins out of her pocket, put them beside the glittering apparatus, and began to work on it. The machine whirred, marked up 2.50 francs, the drawer shot out, and Roland put in her own money with a happy, childlike smile. Curiously, the girls came closer and surrounded the cash register. Roland registered a second time. 1.75 francs.
"What can one get for 1.75 francs at your place?" asked Marguerite, who was otherwise known as the horse.
Roland considered.
"A Dubonnet, 2 Pernod," she said then.
"How much do you charge for an amer piquant and 1 beer?
70 centimes.
Roland registered 0 francs 70 centimes.
"Cheap," the horse said.
"We've got to be cheaper than Paris," Roland explained. The girls moved the wicker chairs around the marble tables and sat down carefully. They smoothed their evening dresses and all of a sudden began to act like visitors at Roland's future café.
"We'd like to have 3 teas with English biscuits, Madame Roland," said Daisy, a delicate blonde who was a special favourite of married men.
7.80 francs. Roland kept her cash register busy. "I'm sorry, but English biscuits are expensive." At the adjoining table, Marguerite, the horse, raised her head after keen deliberation.
2 bottles of Pommery," she ordered triumphantly. She liked Roland and wished to show her affection.
90 francs. Good Pommery.
"And 4 cognacs, breathed the horse heavily. "It's my birthday."
4.40 francs, the cash register clattered.
"And 4 coffees with meringues."
3.60 francs. The enchanted horse stared at Roland. She could think of nothing more. The girls crowded around the cash register.
"How much is it altogether, Madame Roland?"
Roland showed the slip with the printed figures and began to add them.
105.80 francs.
And how much of it is profit?
About 30 francs. That's because of the champagne. You make a lot of money on it.
Good, the horse said. Good. That's how it should always go.
Roland came back to Ravitch. Her eyes were radiant, as only eyes can be when they are full of love or business.
Adieu, Ravitch. Don't forget what I told you.
No. Adieu, Roland. She left, strong, upright, clear-headed. For her the future was simple and life was good. He was sitting with Morozov in front of Fouquet's. It was 9 o'clock in the evening. The terrace was crowded. At a distance, behind the arc, two streetlights burned with a white and very cold light.
"The rats are leaving Paris," Morozov said. "There are 3 rooms empty at the Internationale. That has not happened since 1933.
"Other refugees will come and fill them."
"What kind? We have had Russians, Italians, Poles, Spaniards, Germans."
"French," Ravitch said. "From the frontiers, refugees, as in the last war." Morozov lifted his glass and saw that it was empty. He called the waiter.
"Another carafe of Pouilly."
"How about you, Ravitch?" he asked then.
"As a rat?"
"Yes."
"Nowadays rats too need passports and visas." Morozov looked at him disapprovingly.
"Have you had any up to now?"
"No.
In spite of that, you have been in Prague, Vienna, Zurich, Spain, and Paris. Now it's time that you disappear from here."
"Where to?" Ravitch said. He took the carafe which the waiter had brought. The glass was cool and frosted. He poured the light wine.
"To Italy? The Gestapo would wait for me there at the frontier. To Spain? The Falangists are waiting there."
"To Switzerland?"
"Switzerland is too small. I have been in Switzerland 3 times. Each time the police caught me after a week and sent me back to France."
"England, from Belgium, as a stowaway?"
"Impossible. They catch you in the harbour and send you back to Belgium, and Belgium is no country for refugees."
"You can't go to America. How about Mexico?"
"Overcrowded. And also that would only be possible with some kind of papers."
"Haven't you any at all?"
"I had some discharge papers from prisons where I had been under various names because of illegal entry into the country. That's not exactly the right thing. Of course, I always tore them up right away." Morozov was silent. "The flight has come to an end, old Boris," Ravitch said. "At some time it always comes to an end."
"You know what will happen when war is declared?"
"Of course. A French concentration camp. They'll be bad because nothing has been prepared in advance."
"And then?"
Ravitch shrugged his shoulders. "One shouldn't think too far ahead."
"All right. But do you know what may happen in case everything goes to pieces here while you are sitting in a concentration camp? The Germans may catch you."
"Me and many others. Maybe. It may also be that they'll let us go in time. Who knows?"
"And then?"
Ravitch took a cigarette out of his pocket. "We won't discuss it today, Boris. I can't get out of France. Everywhere else it's dangerous or impossible. Also, I don't want to move on any more."
"You don't want to move on any more?"
"No. I have thought about it. I can't explain it to you. It can't be explained. I don't want to move on any more." Morozov remained silent. He looked the crowd over.
"There is Joan," he said.
She was sitting with a man quite far away, at a table facing the Avenue Georges V.
"Do you know him?"
he asked Ravitch.
Ravitch glanced at them.
"No."
"She seems to change rather fast."
"She runs after life," Ravitch replied indifferently, "like most of us do, breathless, afraid of missing something."
"One can call her by a different name."
"One could, but it remains the same. Restlessness, old man. The disease of the last 25 years. No one believes any longer that he will grow old peacefully with his savings. Everyone smells the scent of fire and tries to seize what he can. And not you, of course. You are a philosopher of the simple pleasures." Morozov did not reply. "She doesn't know anything about hats," Ravitch said. "Just see what she is wearing. In general, she has little taste. That's her strength. Culture weakens. In the end, it always comes back to the naked impulse of life. You yourself are a magnificent example of it."
Morozov grinned. "Let me have my low pleasures, you wanderer in the air. Who has simple tastes likes many things. You'll never be left sitting with empty hands.
who is 60 and chasing after love, is an idiot who hopes to win, although the others play with marked cards. A good brothel sets your mind at peace. The house I frequent has 16 young women. There, for little money, I am a pasha. The caresses I receive are more genuine than those many a slave of love bemoans. Slave of love, I said.
I understand, Boris.
Good. Then let us finish this drink, cool, light Pouilly, and let us inhale the silver air of Paris while it is still free from pestilence.
Let's do that. Have you observed that the chestnuts have bloomed for the second time this year?
Morozov nodded. He pointed to the sky in which Mars twinkled above the darkening roofs, large and red.
Yes, and they say that that fellow up there is closer to our Earth than he has been for many years.
He laughed. Soon we'll read that somewhere a child has been born with a mole like a sword, and that it was raining blood somewhere else. The only thing missing now is the enigmatic comet of the Middle Ages to make all the ominous signs complete.
There is the comet.
Ravitch pointed at the electric signs over the newspaper building, which seemed to chase each other without intermission, and at the crowd which was standing there, silently, their heads bent backward, staring at them. They remained sitting for a while. An accordion player posted himself at the curb and played La Paloma. The rug peddlers appeared with silken caissons over their shoulders. A boy sold pistachios at the tables. It looked as it had always looked, until the newspaper boys came. The papers were almost torn from their hands, and a few seconds later the terrace, with all the unfolded papers, appeared as if buried under a swarm of huge, white, bloodless moths, sitting on their victims greedily, with noiseless, flapping wings.
"There goes Joan," Morozov said.
"Where?"
"Over there, at the corner."
Joan walked across the street to a grey, open car which was parked in the Champs-Élysées. She did not see Ravitch. The man who was with her walked around the car and sat down at the wheel. He wore no hat and was rather young. He skilfully manoeuvred the car out from between the others. It was a low Delahaye.
"Beautiful car," Ravitch said.
"Beautiful tires," Morozov replied and snorted.
"Iron Man Ravitch," he added angrily, "the detached Central European. Beautiful car. A cursed wench, that I could understand."
Ravitch smiled. "What does it matter, wench or saint? It's always what one makes out of it oneself. You with your 16 women, you can't understand that, you peaceful patron of brothels. Love is not a businessman who wants to see a return on his investments, and imagination needs only a few nails on which to hang its veil. Whether they are of gold, tin, or covered with rust makes no difference to it. Wherever it gets caught, it is caught, thornbush or rosebush. As soon as the veil of moonlight and mother of pearl has fallen on it, either becomes a fairy tale out of 1001 Nights.
Morozov took a gulp of wine. "You're talking too much," he said. "Besides, all this is wrong."
"I know. But in complete darkness, even a will-o'-the-wisp is light, Boris." The coolness came on silver feet from the direction of the Etoile. Ravitch put his hand around the frosted glass of wine. It was cool under his hand. His life was cool under his heart. It was born by the deep breath of night, and with it came deep the indifference toward fate. Fate and the future. When had it been like this before? In Antibes, he recalled, when he became aware that Joan would leave him. Indifference that became equanimity, like the decision not to flee any more. They belonged together. He had had revenge and love. That was enough. It was not everything, but it was as much as a man could ask for. He had not expected either one again. He had killed Harker and not left Paris. He would not leave it now. That was part of it. Who profited by chance must expose himself to it too. That was not resignation. It was the calm of a decision beyond logic. Vacillation had come to a stop. Something was set in order. One waited, pulled oneself together, and looked around. It was like a mysterious assurance to which existence committed itself before a caesura. Nothing was of significance any longer. All rivers stood still. A lake lifted its mirror during the night, and the morning would show whither it would flow.
"I must go," Morozov said, and looked at his watch.
"All right. I'll stay on, Boris.
To enjoy the last evenings before the Götterdämmerung, eh?"
"Exactly. All this won't come again."
"Is that so bad?"
"No. Neither will we come again. Yesterday is lost, and no tears or magic spells can bring it back. But today is eternal.
You are talking too much.
Morozov got up. Be grateful. You are witnessing the end of a century. It has not been a good century.
You also talk too much, Boris.
Standing, Morozov emptied his glass. He put it down as carefully as if it were dynamite and wiped his beard. He was in civilian clothes and stood huge and heavy before Ravitch.
Don't think that I don't understand why you won't leave, he said slowly. I can understand very well you're not wanting to move on, you fatalistic joiner of bones.
Ravitch returned early to the hotel. He saw a little lost figure sitting in the hall, who, at his entrance, excitedly got up from the sofa with an odd movement of both hands. He noticed that one of the trouser legs had no foot. Instead, a dirty, splintery wooden stump showed underneath.
"Doctor! Doctor!"
Ravitch looked more closely. In the dim light of the hall he saw the face of a youngster drawn into a broad grin.
"Jeannot!" he said in surprise. "Of course, it's Jeannot!" "Yes, the same. I've been waiting here for you the whole evening. It was only this afternoon that I got your address. I tried to get it several times before from that old devil, the head nurse in the hospital, but every time she told me you were not in Paris."
"I wasn't here for a while."
"Finally, this afternoon, she told me you were living here, so I came right away."
Jeannot beamed.
"Is anything wrong with your leg?" Ravitch asked.
"Nothing."
Jeannot patted the wooden stump as if he were patting the back of a faithful dog.
"Absolutely nothing. Everything is perfect."
Ravitch looked at the stump. "I can see you got what you wanted. How did you get along with the insurance company?"
"Not bad. They allowed me a mechanical leg. I got the money for it from a shop with a discount of 15%. Everything in order."
"And your dairy shop?"
"Oh, that's why I am here. We opened the dairy shop. It's small, but we make out. Mother does the selling, I do the buying and the bookkeeping. We have good sources, straight from the country."
Jeannot limped back to the shabby sofa and fetched a tightly tied package in brown wrapping paper.
"Here, doctor, it's for you. I brought you this. It's nothing special, but all from our shop. Bread, butter, cheese, eggs. When you aren't in the mood to go out, it's quite a nice supper, isn't it?"
He looked eagerly into Ravitch's eyes. "This is a good supper at any time," Ravitch said. Jeannot nodded, satisfied.
"I hope you'll like the cheese. It's brie and some Pont l'Evêque."
"That's my favourite cheese."
"Wonderful."
Jeannot vehemently patted the stump of his leg with pleasure.
"The Pont l'Evêque was Mother's idea. I thought you would prefer the brie. Brie is more of a man's cheese."
"Both are first rate. You couldn't have hit on anything better." Ravitch took the package. "Thanks, Jeannot. It doesn't often happen that patients remember their doctors. Mostly they call on us to haggle about their bills."
"The rich ones, eh?"
Jeannot nodded shrewdly.
"Not us. We are indebted to you for everything, aren't we? If the leg had only been stiff, we would have received hardly any compensation."
Ravitch looked at him. "Does he perhaps believe I amputated his leg as an obliging act of service?" he thought.
"We couldn't do anything but cut it off, Jeannot," he said.
"Certainly," Jeannot winked. "That's clear."
He pulled his cap lower onto his forehead.
"Well, I'll go now. Mother will be waiting for me. I've been away from home for a long time. I got to talk to someone about a new Roquefort, too. Adieu, doctor. I hope you'll like it."
"Adieu, Jeannot. Thank you. And much luck."
"Oh, we'll have luck."
The little figure waved and limped self-confidently out of the hall. Ravitch unpacked the things in his room. He looked for an old spirit cooker, which he had not used for years, and found it. He found somewhere else a package of solidified alcohol and a small pan. He took two squares of the fuel, put it under the boiler, and lit it. The small blue flame flickered. He threw a piece of butter into the pan, broke two eggs, and mixed them. Then he cut the fresh, crisp white bread, put the pan on the table, using a few sheets of newspaper as a pad, opened the brie, got himself a bottle of Vouvray, and began to eat. He hadn't done this for a long time. He decided to buy more packages of solidified alcohol tomorrow. He could easily take the cooker with him into a camp. It was collapsible. Ravitch ate slowly. He tried the Pont l'Evêque, too. Jeannot was right. It was a good supper.